Welcome to X Explored, Women's Brain Health, a dementia researcher podcast exploring the many factors that shape women's brain health across the lifespan.
Hello and welcome to another episode of X Explored, Women's Brain Health. Today we're diving into a very important yet often misunderstood reproductive stage in women's life, which is the midlife transition, also known as the menopause. I'm your host, Dr. Laura Stankiewicz-Uthe, and today we're talking about menopause. In the world, over 1 billion women are going through this stage or already postmenopausal, and this number is expected to rise up to 1.2 billion in 5 years' time. There was a recent study conducted in the UK which found that nearly 1 in 4 women aged 40 to 60 covering this postmenopausal and perimenopausal period that are considering to quit the work due to the menopausal symptoms, and they're 14% of those who are actually considering to do so, if not have done yet. So women make up nearly half of the global workforce population, and many will spend a huge amount of time in the post-reproductive years. Yet our research, support systems, and clinical care still remains patchy. But perhaps it's not all that grey. And in the past years, indeed, we have seen a huge proliferation and a boom towards the topic of menopause, both in research, but also in the societal campaigns, such as Let's Talk About Menopause, to global celebrities sharing their navigation through this difficult and sometimes daunting period. But menopause is still only framed around the topics of vasomotor symptoms such as hot flashes or night sweats, hormonal therapy, or also sometimes mentioned as the reproductive aging, while the brain is still left out of the picture. That's why today's episode will explore how menopause might act not as merely as an endocrine transition, but rather a neuroendocrine tipping point, and will help us understand through this conversation and move menopause from the sidelines into the scientific and societal spotlight. And I'm joined today by two great researchers in this field of women's brain health, but also specifically working on the menopause transition. So they're going to help and unpack these questions. So it's my honor to introduce Dr. Claudia Barth, who holds a professorship for the neurobiology of hormonal transitions at the Department of Psychiatry and Neurosciences, and the research unit Gender in Medicine at Charité, University of Berlin in Germany. She's a biologist and also a neuroscientist by training with a strong background in neuroendocrinology. And another speaker of today, our guest in the series, is Dr. Gillian Coughlin. She's a junior researcher faculty at Harvard Medical School, MGH. And her research projects focus on elucidating personalized risk factors associated with the changes in Alzheimer's disease biomarkers. But also she's extremely interested in understanding how factors such as sex differences may shape different trajectories in AD pathophysiology and cognitive decline. So welcome.
Thank you very much for the invitation. I'm very happy to be here.
Thank you for that introduction, Nora. That was great.
So just before we diving into our main themes of today, I would like to ask just a very simple question. Can you tell in a few sentences, what are you actually doing? Because obviously your biographies are so, so rich, but if you can distill it very, very shortly for our listeners. Claudia, maybe you can go first. You've been thinking for some time.
I want to go first. So my research kind of, as the title of the professorship, where I was luckily, it just got 2 months ago, kind of covers it, how hormonal transition periods impact the brain with relevance to health and disease. We broadly focus on depression and Alzheimer's disease risk, but thereby we focus on diverse hormonal transitions, if it's just menstrual cycle, but also pregnancy and menopause. In the last years, the focus has been very much shifted towards menopause and perimenopause specifically. I recently got a grant from the European Research Council to really tap into what's happening during perimenopause transition. So that's what I am doing, as I just started in my new position like 2 months ago, what I'm actually doing right now is setting up a big study.
Congratulations. This is amazing. And thank you so much for doing the work that you're doing specifically in this area that we know have been historically really difficult to get funding. So kudos definitely for this huge grant.
Thank you very much.
Yeah, so hi, so I'm Gillian Coughlin. I'm junior research faculty at Harvard Medical School, and I'm part of a grant that kind of sets me up to start up a lab the start of 2026, actually, so pretty soon. I'm mostly interested in preclinical Alzheimer's disease, and I look specifically at, you know, sex differences in order to understand disease processes, you know, kind of to a greater degree. So coming at it from more of this kind of personalized medicine approach. And then to understand why women are disproportionately affected by Alzheimer's disease, I also look at things like age at menopause, specifically premature and early menopause, and the use of hormone therapy. And I kind of investigate how those two things are associated with AD biomarkers, primarily amyloid and tau PET, but also plasma biomarkers like p-tau217, etc. So we have a number of different grants now, both from the NIH and different kind of foundation entities, as well as private funding, to look at women's brain health and how it can potentially increase risk for Alzheimer's disease in that postmenopausal stage. So I think at the moment, there's actually so much interest, it seems, on a global level in terms of women's brain health and Alzheimer's disease risk. And there's a lot of research being done, but I'm sure, as we'll discuss today, there's a lot of research that we can also do, I think, over the next 3 to 5 years.
Well, this is a very rich portfolio of topics that you are covering, Gillian. I think there's so many research that's going to come up in the upcoming years from both of your labs, and congratulations to both of you. So to start, I would like to go actually into the very, very basics of the question of what is actually menopause, because sometimes I feel like it's a very confusing topic in terms of its terminology, because, you know, sometimes we may think, or we can hear menopause being described as this one point in women's reproductive life when a woman hasn't had her menstrual period for 12 consecutive months. But of course, that's more of an oversimplification than the reality, because rather it's not just one point, but a culmination of biological changes that have been preceding over the years. So Claudia, could you clarify to us what menopause really is? And then obviously you have mentioned already the terminology of perimenopause. So can you also touch upon that and let us clarify these two concepts?
Of course. You kind of already hinted towards this. So it's kind of actually a lengthy endocrine transition period, which starts with the like progressive failure of ovarian function. So I like to compare it I always like to say it to students. So adolescence is when the hormonal systems go online after they went online once during fetal development and mini puberty. But then menopause is kind of the delayed stage where systems slowly go offline. But it's not that you turn a switch and everything is offline and you stop having cycles. The system goes slightly offline because it's regulated via the HPG axis. I hope I don't mix up the German and the English abbreviation. But basically, the brain regulates the ovaries, and this little dance gets interrupted more and more and more, which leads to erratic hormonal fluctuations, which then eventually cease. And that's the end of the menopausal transition. And as you nicely said, menopause by definition is actually just one time point after you haven't had a menstrual cycle for 12 months. But preceding that, that's what we call perimenopause, which are years of increasing like levels of erratic fluctuation. Normally in the early perimenopausal stages, you get slightly more variations in menstrual cycle length, tentatively more towards shorter cycles. You don't really have symptoms yet, but your menstrual cycle length varies and there are some hormonal markers which slightly start changing. Then in the late perimenopausal stage, which is tends to, on average, be between 1 to 3 years, but there are varying accounts when it comes to the actual length of that. That's where the cycle variations become much more pronounced. Late perimenopause after the Straw criteria are defined by like not having a cycle for 60 plus days. And then that's when also symptoms start to emerge in the majority of women. And that can be sleep disturbances, night sweats, hot flushes, but also cognitive disturbances and depressive symptoms. And then menopause again is this one day. And then postmenopause is kind of starts after 1 year of not having had a menstrual cycle for 12 months. So actually this one point of menopause, which is often used to name the whole transition, is really assessed retrospectively when you can say, okay, no, I haven't had a cycle for 12 months. But also again, for a lot of women, this might not be textbook. Like they might not have a cycle for 1 year, but then it comes back. So it's this system kind of trying to compensate just having another cycle, and eventually it stops and then hormonal fluctuations stabilize and are stably low.
Well, I hope our listeners can appreciate just how complex this whole continuum of pre, peri and postmenopause is. And obviously each stage is accompanied by different symptoms. And you mentioned obviously the vasomotor symptoms, which are those that are related to hot flashes, night sweats, but also you didn't leave outside these cognitive symptoms that sometimes kind of are pushed under the rug. And I would actually like to go a little bit into those ones. So what is the actual neurobiological explanation behind those symptoms? Because obviously it varies. We have different centers in the brain that orchestrate different functions. So we have the hypothalamus, perhaps more related to this thermoregulation, so vasomotor symptoms. But what about these cognitive symptoms? And also we hear that a lot of women are experiencing really huge differences in their mood from what they used to be to how their mood or like even their personality changes. So what do we know about that, Claudia, in terms of the brain specifics?
What we know the most, you already kind of hinted at, is like the changes in thermoregulation due to kind of changes in the hypothalamus. So that's also the most studied symptoms. When it comes to the cognitive symptoms and the depressive symptoms, we don't know that much yet. We know that declining and especially volatility, like this volatile decline in estrogen, it's not just like linearly declining. It's like really fluctuating erratically. And estrogen has multiple functions in the brain, but it's also a very potent modulator of neurotransmitter systems, which are very important for your mood, but also your cognitive function. So that would be one potential mechanism which could like explain disturbances. Then also this estrogen is neuroprotective, and with its declining level, this like neuroprotection might be lifted. And in some women, which then also can contribute to more accelerated aging, but also kind of neurological decline due to structural changes, mainly from animal work, but also for some human studies. And I think Gillian might say more about that later. But there are hints towards like gray matter, white matter changes that Roberta Printon was the first one postulating there might be this bioenergetic shift in the brain that kind of what the brain uses as an energy source might shift. And because glucose metabolism changes, then there is this theory that away from glucose metabolism, it shifts to ketone body metabolizing ketone bodies, which are part of the white matter. And so it's like it's a very complex system, which is likely very tightly interlinked. And then any of these changes might then contribute to mood disturbance and cognitive changes, especially if you already are potentially genetically at risk, if you have a certain lifestyle, so which might not provide resilience against these shifts. And especially also when you already have a history of depressive disorders, depression has been postulated as a very well-established risk factor of Alzheimer's disease later in life. So it's very much tightly connected. But my main statement in this regard would be really structural changes, functional changes, and particularly also changes in neurotransmitter functioning.
Wow. So all of these changes obviously expose then women's brain to be more vulnerable to later life conditions and neurodegenerative diseases because of these fluctuations in hormones that you mentioned, and obviously the critical glucose consumption hypothesis that has been presented by Brenton. So now I'd like to shift the microphone and give the floor to Gillian, because I would like to talk about probably the research area that we work in and the research area that has been receiving so much interest in the greater scheme of menopause, which is Alzheimer's disease. So obviously we know that women make roughly 2/3 of all Alzheimer's disease cases, but obviously it's not just the longevity that explains all of these staggering numbers, but it's actually the underlying biology and the also cognitive trajectories that we see in women. And in the past decades, we have had this hypothesis of menopause really breaching through and suggesting that this is due to the menopausal hormonal fluctuation, specifically due to the decrease in estrogen levels. So I would like to ask Gillian if you could share some evidence specifically advocated for menopause being this critical inflection point in women's life that exposes her to increased susceptibility for Alzheimer's disease.
Yeah, so just as Claudia had beautifully taken us to there, we have this whole like flurry of events that happen around menopause. And then, you know, we as Alzheimer's disease researchers, we're studying women usually in their kind of mid-70s and looking at levels of these neurotoxic proteins that cause Alzheimer's disease, essentially. And so what we do is we look at these women, we image them for these neurotoxic proteins, and then we look back to see how they experience menopause, basically. Now, typically, we don't have data sets that can look at the fluctuations in the hormones around menopause and link them to later AD biomarkers like these neurotoxic proteins. But what we can do is we can look at how women experience menopause in terms of their menopausal symptoms, which will be a proxy for those hormonal fluctuations. We can also ask them, you know, when did they when their last period, which would be their, say, age at menopause. And then we can also ask them whether or not they were treated for menopausal symptoms with HRT. And so I guess one of the things we learned so far is that if women move into this kind of menopausal or perimenopausal state earlier than expected, so particularly before the age of 40 or maybe between 40 and 45, those women seem to be at a higher risk for depositing these neurotoxic proteins, amyloid and tau, later in life. So that association has been shown in our neuroimaging studies, but also shown in these, you know, epidemiological studies that show that the age at menopause is associated with Alzheimer's disease prevalence, right? So then we look at the biology of what that link could be. In terms of hormonal fluctuations, we are writing grants at the moment, and I do know a couple of other scientists in the US who are writing grants to look at how all of those events during perimenopause change the women's brain structure and function in real time. So not necessarily looking at women's brains down the line like we currently are doing, but in real time as the fluctuations in the hormones are occurring. So some of the leading scientists in that area right now would be Roberta Brinton, but also, you know, Emily Jacobs. They have a grant kind of basically looking at exactly these questions. Also, Caitlin Castello, she's another scientist who's very prominent in this area. And then ourselves, so me and Rachel Buckley, we're also proposing a grant to look at perimenopausal effects and how that implicates the brain. In terms of what we look at in the brain in menopausal women, we don't look for the proteins of Alzheimer's disease mm-hmm. because it's very unlikely that they exist at that stage, right? So typically, if menopause is going to increase women's risk of Alzheimer's disease, we won't know that will have officially happened until they are at the age where they can actually start depositing these proteins. So what we instead look at is these other risk factors that might suggest that women are on the road to preclinical Alzheimer's disease. And so some of those things would be like more the plasma biomarkers, also things like inflammatory pathways, vascular pathways, looking at brain structure and function, of course, and brain structure, particularly in subfields of the hippocampus, like the CA3, that would be a kind of region we'd be particularly interested in these menopausal women. And then looking at, you know, the structural integrity of white matter tracts, those kind of things. So those biomarkers are more likely to change due to menopausal changes. And then if they do change, that kind of puts the brain in a more vulnerable state to deposit these neurotoxic proteins later down the line. And it's really the proteins that underlie the actual onset of symptoms in related to Alzheimer's disease, at least. Of course, there are other dementias, but we focus mostly on Alzheimer's. So there's a lot to unpack. Basically, the way we're doing it at the moment is, as I said, we had this big space of time between when women report menopausal symptoms and their menopausal age, and then we get PET scans on them 15 years later. Whereas the way the field is moving is to actually do those imaging studies as the women are actually going through menopause. And that will tell us a lot more basically about how menopause leads women at risk, potentially could leave women at risk of cognitive decline later in life.
So we're seeing that definitely a lot of retrospective studies have laid this foundation where we are now knowing or learning about how menopausal or menopause-related factors are associated with later accumulation of these toxic proteins, but also of structural changes that then also, as you said, kind of lead the brain to become more vulnerable later on. And you mentioned one of the risk factors that you have done in your research is actually the earlier age of menopause. And most of the people probably think of menopause as a natural process as it comes to aging. But obviously, we have different types of menopause, such as surgical menopause. So could you maybe comment a bit on that?
So I think the original hypothesis was that it was probably surgical menopause that would leave women at risk. And we're seeing in our data, at least the data sets we work with, it's not so much the fact that it was a surgically induced menopause. It's more just that the menopause was early, right? So you get this earlier than expected deprivation in circulating estrogens, et cetera. And then the fact that this happens earlier than it should is kind of having the detrimental effect as opposed to it being surgically induced as such. At least that's what we're seeing in the data we look at from the Alzheimer's disease perspective. But just by nature of having a surgically induced menopause, then that is likely happening earlier than the average age of menopause, which is 50, right? It's probably happening before the age of 45, if not before the age of 40. So I think, you know, when we do kind of interviews, we also say it is important for women to always kind of know what's happening with their reproductive health and know if they're getting, you know, surgically induced menopause, that is happening for the right reasons, or at least it's really necessary in their case, because it can have implications for women's brain health and then, you know, the brain health later down the line.
Okay. So obviously that becomes less clear then. It's not just, again, the type, but maybe the age. But then again, maybe there is something behind that that we don't know yet. And probably we don't know how to quantify, because historically the data sets that we are working on, they don't collect that data. Or if they collect, it's not to the extent that we would like to. So I would like to now move a little bit from what we know to what we will know based on both of the work that you are doing, and specifically maybe talking a little bit about the historical blind spots in terms of the methodologies these aging cohorts or Alzheimer's disease cohorts have been using. So obviously, like we know, like ADNI, which is Alzheimer's Disease Neuroimaging Initiative, but we also have more huge data sets that are looking specifically into how individuals develop Alzheimer's disease from preclinical, so this asymptomatic stage where the proteins start to accumulate, but yet in the absence of any cognitive symptoms. But none of these data sets have considered sex-specific variables, or perhaps to a very, very brief extent. And why do you think that was the case potentially? And then the follow-up question, what would be your kind of perfect list of reproductive variables that you would like to include in your studies? Because I know both of you are spinning big grants now. So let's start with Claudia and then go to you, Gillian, with your wish lists.
So yeah, that's a good question, because like I've in the past mainly used like UK Biobank, which is a big UK-based population sample covering 500,000 individuals. And the nice thing of the UK Biobank, it started collecting, so aged inclusion ranges between like 40 and 70, which again is already like actually a bit younger than the most aging cohorts, which normally starts at the age of 65, historically rooted into based on the retirement age in most countries. And the UK Biobank actually does cover the menopause transition, but it has surprisingly little variables on this particular aspect, and has no variables about symptoms. And also, it's really hard to read. We tried multiple times to varying degrees of success to really establish if women in this cohort are perimenopausal. So, yeah, simply knowing if women have symptoms, if they had symptoms, as Gillian said, and that they ask retrospectively, how did you experience the menopause transition, is super important, because that varies a lot. And there is more and more indication that the severity of symptoms, the number of co-occurring symptoms, what kind of co-occurring symptoms, how long they last, might really be critical for how women might age later in life. So like questions around that are really, really important. Then past reproductive history, we found associations between a number of live births and the aging brain later in life. So these kind of variables are really important if women have used hormonal contraception, can be very insightful to know for later brain aging. And so there is now that I'm starting acquiring data across perimenopause, like I'm setting up this like massive baseline questionnaire about reproductive factors and past histories and aged menarche, and like trying to really kind of map out all their reproductive years as kind of comprehensively as possible, to really kind of see what we found in the UK Biobank, if that replicates, but also how that informs how women actively live, as Gillian said earlier, experience perimenopause. So my grant really also kind of has a strong focus on like symptom mapping. So we're using an industry partnership to have an app really for the participants to be able to, on a daily basis, record their symptoms and their experiences, because I think that's a really big, big missing part in all of these cohorts. It's first of all that symptoms are not really acknowledged, but it also it's mainly you have 1, 2, 3 maybe time points. So having also more densely sampled data across these critical inflection points is really, really needed. And I'm really happy to see this trend towards like focusing on perimenopause and then focusing on longitudinal studies during perimenopause, because I got money to do my part, but we need like comparable samples globally, because so we can really look for robustness of effects and generalizability of effects, and also to be able to tap into biopsychosocial aspects. How does it differ between countries? Does it differ between healthcare systems? How kind of the experience of perimenopause and the menopause transition impacts aging later in life? And there are already kind of some indication, not from imaging studies, but more also from when it comes to attitudes towards menopause and mental health, because of attitudes towards might differ between societies and between societal structures and between potentially the Western and kind of the global North and the global South and all these kind of differentiations. So it's nice we're going in this direction of having more varied approaches, although it is still kind of clustered to the global North, I have to admit. But yeah, that's more symptoms, more dense sampling, and ideally in the long run also much more diverse samples, which is not just white women.
Thank you so much for sharing your study as well and what you're going to be doing with this highly phenotyped cohort. And you were obviously saying that this is the global North, but since we were talking about Germany and European perspectives because of your study, my curiosity is, what is the situation on the other side of the Atlantic Ocean, and how are you going to measure and quantify your participants, Jillian?
Yeah, so where to start, really? So I think, well, when it comes to, you know, what we would ask women, Emily Jacobs is actually putting together this standardized questionnaire for, you guys know about it, it's where all researchers in, you know, women's health can basically use the standardized questionnaire, which really covers the scope of things related to menopause, timing, symptoms, etc., but also hormone therapy, type of hormone therapy, dosage, etc. So I think that will probably be incredibly valuable to the field at large, and probably also used in a global scale, not just necessarily in North America, I wouldn't think. And so the interesting thing about women's health is that, you know, in maybe 10 minutes, we can acquire a huge amount of data on women's reproductive health, at least by participant self-report, which has some limitations, but it still would be an awful lot better than kind of the relatively sparse amount of data we have on women's health from these big data sets that we work on at the moment. So there's been a big push for, you know, studies like ADNI, the Wisconsin Registry of Alzheimer's Prevention, the Harvard Aging Brain Study, all of these kind of open access data sets to start including these questionnaires as part of their screening processes. And so I think there is a shift towards that now. So in the next 5 years in particular, I think we'll have a whole host of kind of new data that we can work with from those data sets. In terms of new studies that we're doing, a lot of it is collecting blood samples from the women as they go through perimenopause. So these are more focused studies on, you know, menopause AD link. And then also using those blood samples to run ELISA, which can basically allow us to capture all of these kind of inflammatory and vascular pathways and potentially co-pathologies too, like TPD43 and alpha-synuclein and things beyond just Alzheimer's disease. So I think the studies that we're designing now specifically to look at menopause will be relying heavily on blood samples and looking at hormone levels and all of these other biomarkers. But, you know, when we think about these current big scale data sets that are out there, just bringing in these women's questionnaires will also open us up to a whole kind of new field of data analysis.
Thank you so much. And obviously your wish list allows, you know, all of our listeners who are also potentially thinking about conducting such studies, pay attention to variables that you have mentioned today. I also thought about something that Claudia, you mentioned about the industry collaboration. This is not still a common practice in research environments. Could you tell us how is your journey with that, establishing that collaboration, and how does that collaboration will help you, and how you're using those industry supports?
I kind of used to say when people ask me about that, that I'm just lazy because I don't need to reinvent the wheel if there are much smarter people out there already kind of doing the work. And when I was, because for my study, like we have repeated imaging, we have repeated blood samples, and we have like all the standards we've done in previous studies. But then I was like, okay, how do we actually like really tap into symptom and experiences? And there was already apps out there doing that. And so I reached out to Clue, which is a Berlin-based menstrual cycle tracking app startup. And finally, when I wrote my grant in 2023, like they just released a perimenopause mode in September, and my deadline was in November, and then I just texted them and said, like, I'm preparing this grant, I just saw you released this mode, I would love to use that in my participants, would that be like, are you interested in collaborating, and so on and so forth. And they were super open, so it was like very easy, and gave me a letter of support. I budgeted for that. And so it was like a nice story. And now we're kind of going back and forth also how we could use already acquired data and other kind of angles to really using the data these digital femtech startups are already collecting based on their user base. And Clue has a very nice kind of set up where like in app you also already use if you like already ask if you want to participate in scientific research studies, so that was really reassuring, so that they already have very strict pipelines for research, and also very pragmatically for my context being in Europe, because it's a Europe-based startup, it also follows all the kind of GDPR, which is like privacy law regulations in the EU. So that was also very attractive for me personally, knowing that they would follow the data protection standards we would need for research. So for me, that was a win-win.
That's really inspiring to hear that you have had a really positive experience. And obviously, since we're talking about really highly dense sampling methodologies for our symptoms and potentially biomarkers, I think also the future of research and especially women's health research should move from just laboratory-based studies to more remote settings. And these platforms, these collaborations would allow us to collect the data, whether it's symptoms, whether it's some type of sleep measures from the wearable device, or even like blood-based biomarkers that obviously could be done through the health providers, and then they could put the information related to the sampling time on their application. So I think there is definitely way more bridges that need to be built between industry and research in order to propel what we're doing and maybe fast track a little bit more in the future. So our time is running away today, but it's been a really rich and great conversation about the menopause and why this midlife transition has been really important. Before we close, I would really like to just bring one personal question to each of our speakers. What does women's brain health mean to you? Briefly, in one sentence, personal. Claudia.
It means aging gracefully and as best as possible. And by more research, we can do that.
Beautiful.
Jillian? I think women's brain health for me means
sort of the forefront of research and really coming out of the rug and understanding everything there is to understand about women's brains.
Thank you. So that's it for the second episode of XXplored. A huge thank you to both Dr. Claudia and Dr. Gillian for your insights and really taking us through this difficult period in women's life, but hopefully it's just brought a bit more light and a little bit more understanding. And as I reflect on the things that we have discussed today, there are a few points that kind of really struck a chord in me. And one of them is both your research and what you're doing on opposite sides of the world, trying to bring the woman's brain health, and specifically during that critical, vulnerable period where it coincides with Alzheimer's preclinical stages of the disease, and the multitude of methodologies that you're using, and trying to navigate the questions that you are posing from multiple angles. And I think that just kind of highlights how still under-researched this area is, but with having such work coming up in the future, I'm definitely feeling a bit more assured about my own brain health and also the health of our parents, hopefully. And then another also aspect that probably also our listeners are going to leave with is that it's not just that one time during the woman's reproductive phase. And it's not just the menopause. It's not just the stop in the menstrual cycle. It's not just the drop in estrogen, but it's actually the lifetime exposure of estrogen through variables such as number of children, also the age at menarche, different pregnancy complications, and as well as other risk factors that happen during the whole life that all kind of shape a woman's brain and may increase one's risk. So thank you once again for this great conversation. I really hope that both of you can reconnect in conferences, and also we can bring more research from these great ideas.
Thank you very much for this nice conversation. Thank you, Laura.
So I'm Dr. Laura Stankiewicz-Uta, and you have been listening to XXplored Women's Brain Health on the Dementia Researcher Podcast.
Thank you for listening to XXplored Women's Brain Health Podcast from Dementia Researcher. With generous support from the National Institute for Health and Care Research, Alzheimer's Association, Alzheimer's Research UK, Alzheimer's Society, and Race Against Dementia. From hormones to cognition, from risk to prevention, we feature conversations with researchers, clinicians, and change makers working to challenge assumptions and close the gaps in how we understand and support the female brain.